Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I remain Bob Hill.
And we are in Starlight, Indiana.
We are. Almost
Starlight,
heaven.
Starlight, Indiana is synonymous with the Huber family.
Huberville.
Yes.
And Stumblers.
And we're specifically, there's a great many different areas here in Starlight that are Huber associated.
Right.
But we're specifically at the winery today to talk a little bit about winemaking. 30 years, Bob, they've been making wine here.
And it's an art. It's a science, it's magic, it's all those things. And, you know, you tend to think Indiana wines aren't on a level with other wines around the country, but they really are.
Yeah, they really are.
There's some good wines.
And Ted Huber, along with his cousin Greg Huber, are the proprietors, if you will, of the winery and the orchard. Fabulously trained and engaged and informed, and he's doing some really great things with the grapes that they grow here, turning it into really good wine. It has transcended this, you know, notion of strawberry wine.
There's 28 different wines here alone, and a lot of them seasonal these days, where you hit somebody in the fall and in the winter, and white wine in the summer and red wine in the winter and all that stuff.
Yeah. So we're going to find out more about what they're doing here. It's been 30 years, and I suspect that it'll be another 30 years because they're doing some really good stuff. One of the reasons we came out here was the fact that the winery was introducing a new seasonal wine. It's a Rosado inspired wine like you might find in Spain. They're going to be introducing it. It's Stella de Luce, which means starlight.
Starlight.
That's right.
It's good to starlight the wine.
The label for the wine was some artwork done by David Kochka. So the meeting of the minds, as it were, came up with this notion of introducing the wine and introducing some fabulous artwork that really, I think, is inspired by the culture of the fields, which David will explain later,
right,
of southern Indiana.
Yeah, both Davids are excellent sculptors. We've had some other stuff at Hidden Hill, and they're just as good as it gets, you know, anywhere in the country, really, anywhere in the world. They have fascinating histories, both of them. Their backgrounds are totally different, yet they meet at that wonderful point where art is created.
Mm-hmm.
They help each other a lot. They both have places in southern Indiana, out in the country, so they're certainly attuned to that part of the art.
Yeah, the culture of the fields.
The fields, yes. So stick around, folks. It's going to be a good show.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are coming to you from the Huber Orchard and Winery here in Starlight, Indiana. If you don't know the Starlight and the Huber history, you've been living
here
under a rock, huh?
You've only been here for 10 days.
Yeah. Anyway, all right, Bob, what's going on in your garden?
I'm officially ordering seeds.
Oh, I've already done that.
Have you?
Yeah, get on it, because sometimes if you wait too long, you can't get what you want.
Oh, don't tell me that.
Okay.
We ordered our seeds.
Yeah.
I'm fired up. I got my new little plant room off the kitchen. I'm going to start my seeds in there with little heat pads.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm cleaning out things. I went along the fence row. I've been collecting weird stuff for years, pieces of metal and art and old hubcaps and things that are art-oriented and things that are just junk. And I'm trying to separate the two.
Yeah.
It ain't easy.
Yeah.
But
I know. Cause
but I got one pile of junk and one pile of stuff I saved, and the pile of junk is about the same
size. I was going to say, and you'll probably
if you live long enough,
figure out how to save that pile of junk.
It's like cleaning out your office. After a while, you say, why have I saved this?
Yeah.
So that's where I'm at. And also, I'm checking my equipment, my gasoline engines and my tractor and my stuff, getting ready for spring. So
very smart.
Seeds, equipment, and cleaning out.
Very smart.
Wish you state what's up.
We have ordered our seeds, so I'm on that. I'm starting to get the credit card bill for all of the seed orders.
Yeah.
But spring has sprung because spring training has begun.
Uh-oh.
And I could barely move.
You pulled
morning
a muscle yet?
Yeah. No, that's the thing. You know, we stay pretty active in the winter,
you know,
splitting wood and doing other things.
Yeah.
But the particular task your body gets used to, right?
Right.
So I started cleaning up some perennial beds
in
a more concerted sort of way. And it's a whole different sort of body stretch.
Different muscles.
It is different muscles, you know.
Like going from football to basketball.
Mm-hmm.
We had that all the time
in
high school.
So just a word of warning, ease into it. Make sure you stretch before and after so you're not too terribly sore. And then get disgruntled with your gardening chores.
No, I love that.
I like
feeling
it.
Yeah, I love being tired and sweaty and going to bed at night like a peasant and falling asleep in the bed.
Just all that fresh air and the wind sometimes, you know,
it's just wonderful.
brings that about too. Yeah, absolutely. So, Bob, I can't admit, though, and especially considering where we are,
yeah,
a good glass of wine at the end of the day helps soothe some of that soreness and get the creative juices flowing.
Invite me over, I'll help you get unsore.
That's right. And, you know, in fact, I may take a couple bottles home with us today. We are at Huber Winery, as we had mentioned, and the Huber Family Farm is the quintessential diversified family farm where agritourism is indeed at its best. The family history to this place in Starlight, Indiana, dates back to the 1840s. Today, it includes the orchard, restaurant, farm market, winery, among many other things, in fact. But the winery where we are today, it was added in 1978. Their first bottles were sweet strawberry wine made from their famous strawberries that folks would come to pick from far and wide. Today, the winery produces award-winning wines, continuing a winemaking tradition in Indiana that may surprise many. We'll talk a little bit about that. But we're here with Ted Huber today. He's going to tell us a little bit about winemaking here at the Hubers. Ted Huber, along with his cousin Greg, have taken the helm of the Huber Orchard and Winery component to all of this. Ted is also the head winemaker and the master distiller here, and I'm sure he's got some good tales to tell in terms of winemaking here in southern Indiana. Ted, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we were the farm actually was established back in the 1843s with vineyards, the orchards and strawberry fields and other fruits, and wines and brandies were made in 1843 here at the farm. So
it's just sort of a modern manifestation of something that's been a long tradition, huh?
Exactly. You made mention that people probably didn't realize the rich history of what southern Indiana and Kentucky had with vineyards back in the mid-1800s, but this was the major producer of the Napa Valley of the United States back in the mid-1800s.
So that was for commercial at the time then, too?
That was for commercial, yeah. Cincinnati was kind of the hub for the wine industry. Then it was bottled and transported back up east. So a lot of the farms along the river down through here were producing both fruit wines and grape wines for the masses and either transported in barrels or bottles back for the consumption.
So Ted, what is it about this area, I guess, that makes it suitable to growing grapes, which then translate into good wine?
But that's a great question, and you can simply look out of the tasting room window and you can see what goes on. We're on top of the Knobstone Escarpments, or the unglaciated area of southern Indiana.
Okay.
And so the soils and the climate and the way the wind moves and how the water runs all plays a factor into the overall flavor profiles of the wines. And I can't take credit for that. It goes back to my great-great-grandfather, who came from Germany, him and his two brothers, looking for a place to establish a vineyard and wine operation and fruit farm like they had in the Baden-Baden region of Germany. And just settling through Cincinnati and moving down the Ohio River into the Louisville area, they could see the knobs. You could see, it's very clear of how the elevation works up here, which would be very similar to the Black Forest or the Baden-Baden region of Germany. And that's where they came from. It was just they knew how to grow fruit. They knew how the climates work on top of hills like this. And so they came up here and set up claim. And our 550 acres, it's only about a third of it is really suitable for growing premium wine grapes. The rest of the farm, the way the hills face or maybe bottom ground, it just isn't suitable for growing grapes, but where the edge of the Knobstone is where we like to keep the vines on. We got great air movement, great water movement, keeps the frost problems down, and which the problem we have also is heavy rainfall and water runs downhill.
All right, so maximize drainage, huh?
That's right.
I was surprised to learn you've got 28 different cultivars of grapes growing up here.
Yeah, different varieties. The wine-consuming public in the Midwest is a very diversified group of people. and we are a retail winery. About 90% of our wine is sold here at the winery. So we get people who have never had wine before in their life. Then we may have a person walking the door is a very complex Cabernet Sauvignon fan. So we grow varieties of grapes to make a lot of different styles of wine. To basically for everybody to come here to the farm and have a great wine experience. If you're a sweet wine drinker, a lighter white wine drinker, heavy, complex red wine drinker, we hope to have a wine that will suit your taste.
And in fact, I mean, that's, I think what you all have done so well over the years, as we said, you guys are celebrating your 30th year as a winery. That's a long time in this newest incarnation, of course. Started out with the strawberry wine. Now you have award-winning wines that, as you say, are very complex. Let's talk about a couple of the wines that have sort of evolved more recently. I know one that you're very proud of and introducing here pretty soon, a seasonal variety. It's a Rosato, the name of which reflects the origin, Stella di Luce.
Stella di Luce, Starlight.
Starlight.
Being Starlight, Indiana.
Exactly.
And
so
Rosato being rosé.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we were trips to Europe and enjoying some of the wines. We always like to keep in touch of what the other parts of the world are doing with the styles of wines that they're producing. And a recent trip to Spain and understanding and seeing what they're doing over there, and all of the people on this nice summer afternoon enjoying these rosados. Here in the United States, we think of pink wines being white Zinfandel, which is nothing like this style of wine. This wine is a much more rich, much more complex, heavy, and bone dry, no sweetness at all. Taking that mentality of wine drinking back here to the United States and playing with it for several years and coming up with this particular blend that we have. And it's a blend of both Cabernet Sauvignon and Cabernet Franc and another red variety we grow called Chamberson. And the blend of the free run or unfermented skins, no skin contact with the rosé, just basically bleeding off the really nice, fresh, fruity free run juice, not having any seed contact or skin contact of a traditional red. So it's lighter and fresher and fruitier than a red wine, but much more complex and heavy than a white wine because it's being made from the red grapes.
So what gives it its color? I mean, just that it's there, yeah, even though you're bleeding off just the juice, but just the fact that the skin's still there is that gives it the
just
tint
enough
of color.
Skin contact. Yeah.
Okay.
When we harvest grapes here in this part of the United States, temperature becomes a big factor because we warm up so quick. In places of California, they may not warm up as quick, but we typically like to have our vines harvested and the grapes in the cellar before 11 o'clock in the morning before it starts getting too warm.
Okay.
And so the first thing we'll do is go ahead and separate the stems off of the berries themselves, and the berries go on over to a fermentation tank. And then sometime about 3, 4, 5, 6 o'clock, depending on the year and the concentration of flavors and colors that the skins might have in that particular year, that free-run juice is pumped off of that tank. So it does have just a small amount of skin contact just to give it the hint of color, plus to add a little bit more body and structure. Because if we just pressed it right away, right when it came in, it would be considerably lighter and not quite as complex.
So where did the skins and the seeds go after you've extracted the Rosato
juice? That's the whole magic of why this wine was really easy for us to make. In 1988, when we put forth a complex dry wine here at the winery, we started making those in 1988. One of the methods that we used to make more complex red is a French method called saignée. Saignée means bleeding. And by bleeding is what I just explained of taking the free run juice off of the skins. And by doing that, we concentrate both the skins and the seeds. Skins having most of the anthocyanins that make up the pigment compounds and also most of the tannins. And the seeds have a lot of those more complex tannins. Mm-hmm. We concentrate that in the tank to make our red wines better, more complex, and have the ability to age. Most of our heritage, which is our best blend of our red grapes, almost the same blend as the Rosato, we pretty much almost guarantee customers a 10 to 15-year age on those wines. That's how big and how complex we're making the reds.
Wow. How long typically from the field to the wine glass here at Huber's?
That will vary. A very great question there. Like a strawberry wine and the peach and the real fruity fruit wines, they're as little as 3 to 6 months. With most of the white wines and blush wines, they're around the 6 months to a year. And the more complex and heavy the red, it could be as little as 2 years, or it could be as much as 3 to 4 years before it's ready to be poured.
Now, some's aged in wood and some aged in the stainless. Tell us about that.
Well, like the Rosato, we're trying to keep that really true to its flavor profile, or really true to what the grapes would taste like or the real juice would taste like. So we don't want to influence any other flavor. flavor. So we pick certain yeast strands and certain enzymes and a fermentation techniques to really bring those fruit flavors forward. Now with the red wines, we want to add more complexity, more body, more interesting, darker, complex flavors. So those wines will definitely see wood barrels. And our wood barrel program here is a very interesting program. We use both Kentucky and Indiana and Minnesota forest here in the United States. We also use European oak from different regions of France and Eastern European. Depending on the flavors that we're looking for, the oak barrels are made every year for the particular vintage. So we have a really unique barrel warehouse of, wow, of different barrels and different styles.
Now the tasting process, how often are you tasting it toward the end to get exactly what you want? Every week, every day, every minute?
With the reds, when the reds go into the barrel, they're put into the barrel this time of year in January and February, and the bung is put into it, and we don't taste them again until July. July, every barrel is tasted, the barrel is topped, and then it's put it back into the barrel warehouse and not tasted again until the end of December. All of the January and most of February, almost 6 to 8 weeks is put together to come up with the blend. So we're tasting about every other day to do the blending of those wines. We're getting ready to start blending our white wine program up. It's considerably quicker. We have barrels only 60 gallon, where a tank of white wine will be anywhere from 500 to 2,000 gallon. So a lot less potential for blending. So blends go quicker with the white wines.
So Ted, does everything happen here, you know, from growing the grapes to processing them to, you know, bottling?
That's
everything?
One of the things we're most proud of. We try to maintain as an estate bottled winery, which we currently do and have been for going on over 20 years. So over 75% of our fruit that we use in our wine is grown right here on the farm. And typically in a normal years, we maintain 90% or higher, as long as we don't have bad freezes, frost problems, or some other things that might damage the winery. So as fast as we grow our winery, we try to also grow our fruit farm, both from the fruits other than grapes and grapes.
Do you purchase from any other growers in the area?
Yeah, we like to, if we are going to purchase, we'll like to purchase under a contract. So people are growing the grape that we want in the style that we want that grape grown in. And then so we'll contract with them to grow it for us under our specs. So we know as winemakers what we're going to have this fall.
Are they local growers as well?
Yeah, they're local. They're typically from this region. So maybe as far north as Bloomington, Indiana, or as far south, maybe closer to the river here in Clark or Floyd or Harrison County.
And you're allowed to ship now?
Yeah, we're allowed to ship. Very good question. With the seasonal wines that we come out with, shipping is a very important part of that because these wines may be on the market for as little as weeks, not months. And so our customer base may not have the opportunity to be able to drive up here to Starlight while that wine is available. But so both in Indiana and Kentucky currently, we have licenses that allow us to ship directly to our customers in those states. In the state of Kentucky, you must be in a either a wet or a moist county. In the state of Indiana, there's some signatures that are required to verify 21, but it's a fairly easy process.
At this point, how do you continue to sort of top yourself? You know, the new Rosado is a perfect example of something very contemporary, very dynamic, something that I think will engage the wine drinking public, you know what I mean, kind of keeping it up to date. What do you all sit down and talk about around the kitchen table in terms of how to keep this thing going and continue to represent what you all want to do as a family and as a family farm, but also...
That's easier done than you think. One nice thing about being in the Midwest is trends always happen on the coast or in Europe and work their way into the Midwest.
So you have a chance to.
So we have a chance to prepare for that. And so winemaking, myself and Jason, we try to get to California at least once, if not twice a year, to meet with winemakers and to meet with grape growers. We try to get to Europe at least every other year to see what's going on, to see the trends in what's being planted, what's being produced. Try to keep in touch with the wine-consuming public and what the public wants to do. Right now, it's a big trend. People want to get out to the country. They want to spend time in the country. And while they're out here, they want to be entertained a little bit. So
there's a lot to choose from.
So we're changing changing how our business operates about every year to change with the mix of our customers and what our customers want.
Another thing that you guys have added in the recent past is a distillery.
Yep.
Starlight Distillery.
Starlight Distillery.
So not just a winery, but also a distillery. What's coming out of the distillery?
Distilleries are slower about products than wineries due to the fact of the distillation aging process. In 2001, the state of Indiana and the federal government granted our license to start producing. And being a very large farm, one thing about fruit farms, you have these wild years of production, not just 100% crop, but literally 120, 130%, 30% more than you could ever expect. And our focus here at Huber's is try to bring people to the farm and sell our products here, not wholesale them around the world. And so when we get these years of excessive production years, our distillery allows us to put products away for a very long time. Wow. We're able to distill and concentrate like a 1,000-gallon tank of wine, literally concentrate all of the flavor and the alcohol into as little as 80 gallons. and then that stores a lot simpler than a 1,000-gallon tank in a corner
of
a room.
Don't have to drink as much to eat.
Is it just wine, or can you distill other products?
Currently with our license, we can only distill fermentable products that are in the wine family. So we have this year our launch will be the apple brandy. So hopefully by the apple season this fall, our apple brandy from the 2001 in a blend of the 2002 vintages, which have been barreled since then, will be out. And then we have our current grape brandy that's been on the market for a couple years. And the really hot one right now is the grappa, which is a distilled product from the leftover grape skins. These grape skins still have sugars and alcohol in them when they're done. And we simply put those in the still along with the Italian tradition of producing grappa and produce a really nice flavored grappa.
So the whiskey's on hold at this point?
We would love
Kentucky's,
it.
Kentucky's got the corner.
Bill Samuels, are you listening?
One other question for you. Tell us a little bit about the Indiana Uplands Wine Trail. I think it sort of exemplifies certainly what's going on today, but that rich winemaking heritage that Indiana has. 9 different wineries?
There's currently 8.
Eight?
But there's a couple new ones that have started within the wine trail that that'll probably come online here in a couple years. The Upland Wine Trail gives people an experience to be able to travel around and see what agriculture's like. Some of the grape varieties that we grow, all of the wineries grow. And so you're able to, like, go into Napa Valley or another wine region that might be in Europe or somewhere else, and travel the wine trail and experience what the nuances of the soil and the style,
and
it really
people.
Brings the artistic style of winemaking out, because all of us winemakers in the Upland Wine Trail all have our unique flair. We're doing things similar, but we all put our individuality on every bottle.
Now, what are some of those towns, Ted?
The far north is the Upland. The Upland, again, is part of the Knobstone Escarpment.
Okay.
Is the eastern most part of the Upland area, and the Upland area in Indiana is the unglaciated part of Indiana. And so we picked that region to have the wineries in because the soils are similar from top to bottom. If you go east of here and you get out of the Upland region or north of here, the soils change and the climates change. So Bloomington, Indiana is the furthest north. The furthest west would be over towards French Lick, the French Lick Winery.
Okay.
And then south would be the Turtle Run Winery in Lanesville, Indiana.
Right.
So the Upland pretty much dives into Ohio River and runs along I-65 north to Brown County around Bloomington and the back south back into the river again. And all the wineries that are in the Upland region are in that region.
Sounds like a nice way to spend the weekend.
Nice trip. We got 7 to go.
We do. This has been fabulous. I'm so impressed. The wine's been fabulous. I look forward to taking a couple bottles home.
Good. Well, thank you guys for coming out.
Thanks
a lot, Ted. Ted Huber is the co-owner and head winemaker for Huber Orchard and Winery. The winery celebrates its 30th year this year. Please see our website at WFPL.org for more information on the Huber Winery, their wines, and the upcoming art and wine event celebrating the new seasonal wine Stella Dolce and the artwork of David Kochka and David Lynn. We'll be talking to them after the break.
You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Janine Wishy.
As much as I hate the wine tasting part of this show, Miss Wishy, we've got to move on to the...
We do. But I bet you they'll let us taste some more after we finish this.
Well, I hope so, kid. Yeah.
Between each segment, we get to taste some wine.
And we've got a great second half of the show. It's going to be a couple artists who are going to actually bring their art out here to Huber's.
Two of the things that go so well together are art and wine, my worldview.
Yeah.
And coming up, there's a special event to highlight the Davids, as we're calling them, their artwork certainly, but also to highlight the Stella Dolce seasonal wine that David Kochka had done the artwork for the label. But they saw it as a great opportunity to bring the two together, introducing this wine, also sharing two great local artists' work at the same time, February 22nd through the 24th. Mm-hmm. Dick Sisto is going to be out here as well. So a great event. But we just wanted to give everybody a heads up about that going on out here at Huber Winery. And we've got the artists that are going to wow us with their craft.
They are David Kochka and David Lind, who have taken separate paths to their upcoming show at Huber Winery, but both have been inspired in part by nature. We're going to talk about that today. David's, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you.
And you can call us Click or Clack. It might be easier. I'm not sure.
And they are dressed, folks. There's not a naked David in the house. I want to tell you that.
But there will be.
Yeah. You have to one more wine tasting. Right?
Let's start with David Lind. Let's talk about your background and how you ended up in art.
How I started in art.
And how you finished.
Well, our hope is not finished.
Right, yeah.
Well, I decided for this show that a cute thing to do would be a self-portrait. And my mama showed me pictures of me, and I did a piece that is me at 2 years old in a diaper and a cowboy hat with a paintbrush. And I think it pretty much started then.
Yeah. How about the cowboy part?
Well, that was, who were the icons then?
Hopalong Cassidy.
Yeah, well.
Roy
okay.
Rogers.
Yeah, cowboy was the thing. We came from the West.
And David Koch has got an equally fascinating, if not diverse, road to art. Tell us about your background.
My background came drawing cartoons from the comic strips to begin with, and then from there I ended up meeting a sculptor. I'm from a little village up in Minnesota, and met a sculptor up there named Paul Granlin, and he sort of was so interesting and got me involved in being part of his activity there. He asked me one day to be an apprentice. And it was my first introduction to sculpture, and I was about 19 at the time, and I was planning on going into graphic arts at that time. But he got my taste buds going for this bronze business going, and I've just followed it ever since. Went to St. Louis University with it, went to Europe for some years, and ended up in the Knobs of Indiana, and I've been here for 25 years, so I'm almost as old as David.
So
the other David, that
so
is.
So David Kochka, you're primarily a bronze sculptor, you know, for all intents and purposes. He's a bit of a Renaissance man, too, but that would be a whole other hour show, I'm sure. David, your medium is painting predominantly, sculptor? Are you everything?
Bronze. Okay. But after I painted in a cowboy hat and I got a little older, I was painting automobiles. Uh-huh. And there's a lot of people in this area that saw some cute cars. I mean, they would have been cute in the garden.
Yeah.
And we showed at Carl Casper and had all that fun. And then I was fortunate enough to meet Paul Fields, who a lot of people know.
Sure.
And I learned mold making from him. And then he was kind of pushing me towards Barney Bright at that time. So when I was when I had the opportunity to be apprentice with Barney, we did the search in front of the New Albany Floyd County Public Library.
Right.
So there's many hours on that piece that I have sacrificed blood and skin to.
Yeah. So you've been with some of the area's greatest sculptors, to be sure.
Well,
and you can
probably
count yourself among them now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to count myself, but I keep doing it.
Yeah.
It was suggested that there was a educator from Rodin that came to Louisville School of Art,
mm-hmm.
and Barney trained through him, so I thought, well, yeah, this is a good trail to get a hold of. And at that point, for that casting, Barney was sending his work to Detroit, and he was thinking, because I wasn't smart enough at that time, to have his own foundry. and we picked up on some information, and we would go to the secondhand store down the street and buy vacuum sweepers, turn them around, hook it up to natural gas, and melt metal.
If not 70 or 10 fingers.
But that's pretty much how the Louisville foundry process started.
Now, David Kotcha, both of you ended up in the country, which is kind of neat. Tell us about that connection between earth and sky and your work.
Yeah, well, first of all, we're from Indiana.
There you go.
And we're stuck between Louisville, as they say,
right.
And I learned how to say that, between Louisville and Indianapolis. And we're sort of lost in that space in between.
Right.
And at the same time, that probably gives us the grace to do what we really want to do anyway.
Well, the jet stream likes it, too. we're getting decent weather.
What David, I think, lives on, 20 acres, David, or something like that?
26 acres.
26 acres with a lake, and I've got 140 out in the middle of Laconia. And primarily, we like the solitude, we like the leisure, we like the contemplative pauses that can happen out in that kind of space. And for me, and I've used the metaphor in a monograph, I talk about the agricultura.
Right.
The agriculture,
right.
Which is really a metaphor of the culture of the fields or the field culture.
Right.
And we really come from the field culture, as all of us, most America does. And since we're in a rural setting, what we wanted to highlight, and that's why I came to Ted and Dana to ask them, I talked to them about the field culture, and as an artist, being a winemaker, I mean, art in its primary definition is the right way of doing something.
Right.
And the same kind of labor that we do, it's David and I, as bronze casters, are alchemists and
right.
shaman and magicians in that level.
And
so is Ted. I would be a different.
Yeah.
I'd have feathers and
such.
Stuff. but the notion of agriculture struck me, and the coming from the culture of the fields really indicated to me that we come from a primal source of community, shared community, interdependence more than independence, and we share a lot of things in common and help one another. So David and I really stand for community and culture, but not just the culture that is the pop culture. We come from the earthy
yeah.
culture that wants to manifest, and so we got together with Ted and Dana and suggested, let's do a celebration. We'll bring the fruit of our labor to your fruit mm-hmm. and mix it together.
Well, you don't do anything alone. It
no.
takes two logs to burn.
Yeah.
Now, did each of you make a piece particular for the show related to the winery and the agriculture and so forth?
I was drinking wine when I made that self-portrait.
not specific. Well, actually, I find that my wife's a... I put rocks or sculptures in our yard,
yeah.
and the next thing I know, there's gardens around it.
Yeah, right.
Sometimes, even to the detriment of my sculpture, that I have to move them because the garden has gotten so big. But what I've learned from her, I've even taken like sunflowers, for example, and cast those, and some leaves when we do our garden stuff that we
right.
did at the garden show
mm-hmm.
with your dad.
Yeah.
But primarily, my stuff is figurative as well. It's a lot more loose than David. David's fine and. In terms of his refinement of it and his craft of it, I tend to be a little bit more reckless. Yeah, Dave would say he would say reckless or something like that.
He was about to say it. It was all over
but,
the face.
But I also have been. I like more abstract expressionism. So
yeah.
I take a lot of my clues from the growth of vines and those sorts of things
mm-hmm.
in my abstract pieces that I'd like to do. But well,
yeah.
you got to sell them to make a living. So.
Yeah, to that
you
end,
do what you have to do.
You've got the show coming up here, but beyond that, do you welcome visitors in your home? Do you have galleries where people can see your art?
They're welcome.
Oh, I spend a lot of time working alone at home. I love a visitor.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially if they show up with a bottle of wine.
That's fine. That's fine. A pair of gloves, good.
Okay.
So if people call ahead, they're welcome to come out and see the
yeah.
Davids
yeah.
at work.
Oh, yeah. We also have, at my studio, we have a studio foundry and forge area, and David's got a studio as large as my whole complex, but we share the burden and the experience of casting together, but we have
share
a boundary.
The we
have
fruits of the cast.
Yes, whatever comes out of the molds.
So talk about the process of being a, what was the term you used before, a bronzer, a
founder,
but I mean like
broadcaster.
Broadcaster, thank you. Well, take us through the process of being a bronzer.
What I enjoy about it, after especially talking with Ted and hearing how he's working with the earth, to this day I'm still amazed that you can take clay or dirt from the earth and make anything you want, pull a mold on it, cast it in metal, and have it forever.
Forever, yeah. Right.
And my understanding is the process is approximately 5,000 years old. Mm-hmm. And when my friends tell me they're having computer problems, I like saying, well, I'm working with a 5,000-year-old process.
Yeah.
Now, we still have problems, but we can work them out.
So you make a cast out of?
Well, you make the original out of clay. You have to have an original of whatever material you want to make it out of.
And it's
of.
Always made out of clay?
Yeah,
you can be made
be
out
wax,
of something else.
Plaster, anything,
okay.
Yeah.
Wax, which is a petroleum product, still earth.
Right.
And, I mean, there's many approaches, but that's the way I like doing it because it is absolutely plastic. It's fluid.
Mm-hmm.
You can do anything you want with it. So there's no limitation.
Mm-hmm. So once you have your original cast,
Have the model
mold.
First, then you make a mold of the model.
Okay.
Which is usually a type of plaster or rubber, depending.
So you can pour something in between the little spaces
and
in between?
Yeah.
Within 5,000 years, they've developed rubber that makes very nice
it's
molds.
It's a lot easier.
Okay.
But nevertheless, you cover that image with plaster, and then you take it apart, and you put your clay back in the barrel. You put the mold back together, and then you pour molten wax inside of that and pour it out to get a hollow.
Okay.
So it's like pouring in a glass,
that's
wax,
the hollow
and
space.
Out. And that's the hollow stuff.
Okay.
Then you take the mold apart, and then you work that wax, and we have what we call a throwaway mold or destructed mold that we do with it's very. You have to see it. You have to come and visit, folks.
No. Okay.
You take the wax pattern and you dip it into ceramic shell slurry. It's almost like thick potato soup.
Uh-huh.
And then you stucco it with a silica sand. That's one coat. You do that about 12 times. It makes a mold. Then you put it in a kiln and you burn the wax out. That's why they call it lost wax or cire perdue. And then you pour the metal where the wax was.
Gotcha.
Oh.
And
you
that's
melt
the
it
alchemy.
Out and that's your...
And then you break that mold apart, but you have a reserve mold to get another wax if you want to do it in addition of them.
Uh-huh.
And then there's that moment of truth when you're looking at it.
Well, that's it's either Christmas or something else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You never
that's
know.
What you give to your mom, right, for Christmas.
And sometimes those mistakes really become, now for, at least for me from an abstract expressionist point of view, those mistakes tend to be some of the magic that's involved in some collage of phonic developments.
Yeah.
How long does it take to, you know, after the creative process, of course, it's worked itself out in terms of coming up with your artwork, how long does the process take to where you would have a finished bronze
piece?
Well,
it really depends on the size of the project because it's like the search I was telling you about.
Uh-huh.
That was over
how many
100
people?
Pieces.
Okay.
So it became a three-dimensional puzzle at that point. So if you've got something 12 inches tall and you get a good casting, you can clean it up and make it real nice in, I don't want to count hours, but I'm going to say a couple few days.
Mm-hmm. So do you have any tips on situating three-dimensional sculptures in an outdoor setting? I know David Kochka's got good experience, especially with his wife's gardens emerging around them. But
with your dad's show, that was the first endeavor because I thought, you know, people need toilets and they need sculpture. And they might cost a little bit different, but primarily it's something that people, you know, paintings go all with your couch and your wallpaper, what have you. But we wanted to bring sculpture to the people, and that's part of the reason we wanted to come out here as well.
And there are toilets that cost as much.
Yeah.
And you're right. You're absolutely right. So what we did was... with your dad's show, with the garden show, was we brought the bells and the whistles and the some of David's sculptures in terms of his fountains and different things like that, and we tried to introduce people not only to the forged gates and stuff that we did, but to the sculptural elements that these things can fit into your garden setting, and they become, I think, a certain crowning of that earthiness. You know, there's a certain spirituality, it seems to me, that goes along with a garden.
Yeah.
You've got the compost pit, that's the microcosm of your of our little world. And it as I watch my wife Judy, it really becomes a contemplative moment, but contemplation on the hoof is what I refer to it. She's contemplating as she moves, but it becomes that leisurely place where a little crown of something that comes from human consciousness can enhance some of the environment, I think.
Are you still evolving?
Evolving?
As artists.
Well, we're not playing artists anymore. So we've got time to evolve and play and attempt new things.
Yeah, and I mean, and does part of that come with age and experience that there's a different sort of
freedom
in your artistic expression, maybe more relaxed sort of? I mean,
failure is allowed too.
Yeah, or maybe even more allowed now.
It's either Christmas or not.
Yeah. But we still get ticked off about
it. Is it easier now because you've already
the skills are honed,
all this stuff? Yeah.
To a certain degree.
Mm-hmm. And we're not particular. That's part of why we want to come here to Ted's Place is that we want to bring it to the people because they don't come and find us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we're lost between Louisville and Indianapolis anyway. But the skills are honed, and we're still learning new things and investigating new things.
And you asked the question as we go through time, how does it change? One thing that I've found interesting, I've been fortunate enough to have put probably 40 pieces in Cave Hill Cemetery for people. And I find it interesting that if you develop a piece for a garden, and you live with that while this person is in your love life, and you end up losing them, it can be used for the
memorial.
Permanent marker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And or urn, even.
Mm-hmm.
And
I hope my wife is listening to this.
Call her up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, David Kotcha and David Lynn, thank you very much. Enjoyed it. And I want to tell folks to come out and see their work at the release of the new Huber wine on February
22nd through the 24th.
Up in the beloved knobs of Southern Indiana.
That's right. Every road in Southern Indiana has a sign.
To get here.
To get here.
All
Stella
roads lead here.
Stella di Luce. Ricordati.
That's right. Follow the signs to the Huber Orchard and Winery.
For more information on the artists and where to find their work or where to find Huber's, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Strawberries, cherries, and an angel's kiss in spring. My summer wine is really made from all these things.
I walked in town on silver spurs that jingled too. A song that I had only sang to just a few. She saw my silver spurs and said, let's pass some time. And I will give to you summer wine. Summer wine.
Strawberries, cherries, and an angel's kiss in spring. My summer wine is really made from all these things. Take off your silver spurs and help me pass the time. And I will summer wine, oh, summer wine.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Yes, you are.
And we're at Huber's, and I'm watching our producer man the equipment and sip wine, and it's just the most delightful thing I have seen in a long time.
He's a multitasker.
Yes.
He can
He's
do
a Renaissance
it.
Man as well.
We
had
it.
To stop drinking, however, to get back to work, but that's
yeah,
okay.
But we've got some questions to deal with her also.
We do have some questions.
First one for you, Miss Wishy.
All right.
From a Kelly Brown. It's mm-hmm. a good question. I need to kill weeds in a school flower bed, but due to regulations cannot use any sort of pesticide or weed killer. What can I do for a natural weed killer?
Let's see. Salt.
Plastic?
plastic.
I use plastic.
But plastic only works to a certain degree. I mean, like, plastic will smother it out, and then pieces of board.
Yep.
My friend Bruce F. Solage, another Southern Indiana plant fabuloso person, he will put down boards or even cardboard, whatever, if he wants to kill out a spot in his little prairie, you know, to plant new stuff. Yeah. Just smother it out. So plastic boards, salt, vinegar.
And a shovel.
Shovel. Get weed it. Exactly.
Yeah. But the good, the bad news is there's going to be weeds in the ground.
Right. I wonder if the school will allow, like, organic products like the corn gluten, which
they should,
she can
sure.
use. Yeah. I would think they would be able to.
Absolutely.
So that, yeah. That's a pretty good list of organic measures.
You did so well, I got another one for you.
All right.
From Carolyn and Edward Parrish. Is it too early to plant snow peas in February? Also, can you recommend a website for vegetable planting schedule for our area in Louisville?
Absolutely. And just because they're called snow peas
right.
doesn't mean they want to grow in the
they're
snow.
More like March peas.
I would say that it's still a bit too early, and mostly it's soil temperature.
Exactly.
Peas will germinate in cooler soils, but not as cool as what we're experiencing right now. Typically, mid to late March, you can get your peas in, but it really just depends on the weather, don't you think, Bob?
Yeah, and that's a good point to make. It's the ground temperature.
It is the ground temperature.
That's the whole thing. You can think it's okay. The calendar can tell you it's okay, but if it's a real cold spring, it ain't okay.
It ain't okay. And in terms of the planting schedule, and better yet, in terms of the soil temperature that's necessary for certain seed to germinate, right?
Right.
The Jefferson County Extension Service, if you're in Louisville, they'll have links to the University of Kentucky's website, which provides all that extension information. And there's loads of good information, planting schedules, temperatures, you know, things like that. So University of Kentucky's website, just type in University of Kentucky Extension Services.
There it is.
Seed starting, you know, that sort of thing. It'll pop up. But peas, you want to start them in the ground where they're going to grow. They don't transplant, so you don't want to start them in a cold frame or on the windowsill or whatever. So just wait, and they'll be fine growing on their own when the time is right.
If you have a pea or Q question for Ms. Wishy, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@wfpl.org or call us at 502-814-8246. Miss Wishy, you hit one of my favorite songs of all time with your Latin word of the week.
Oh, did I?
Yeah.
The Vitifolia?
He heard it through the grapevine. That's as bad as I can get it.
Yeah, that is as bad as you can get it. But yeah, the Latin word of the week this week, maybe a little too predictable, but it is vitifolia, vitifolius, or vitifolium. And it means with leaves like
a grapevine.
A grapevine.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of examples, which is not surprising, really, because loads of plants have grapevine-like leaves.
Including grapes.
Including grapes. Anemone vitifolia.
The grape-leafed windflower. I love it.
Yep. Passiflora vitifolia.
The perfumed passion flower.
So not only is it very perfume-scented.
Yeah. What a great plant.
It has.
Beautiful flower. I love the seed pod.
Foliage.
Folks, plant a perfumed passion flower as soon as possible.
There we go. Hibiscus vitifolius.
Tropical hibiscus.
Yep, which has grape.
Yep, grape foliage.
Foliage. Rubus vitifolius.
Pacific dewberry. I haven't done that one.
Yep. Abutilon vitifolium.
Indian mallow.
Abutilon, and one of those edible flowers that you often will find on your plate at a fancy restaurant for some pretty accent. Acer vitifolium.
Oh, the Japanese maple.
One of the Japanese maples.
You can't beat it.
Pelargonium vitifolium.
Another great one. The grape leaf geranium.
Right. So not surprising, really. Lots of geraniums have sort of grape-like leaves, don't you think?
Yep. If you hear the word vitifolia, look for grapevine-like leaves.
There we go.
Vital to do that.
Yes. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, we'll have the All-America selections for 2008 and a little more information on some cool annuals you can add to your garden this year.
Homegrown is produced by that wine connoisseur, Brad Yost, in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.